Hello, boys and girls. Welcome to the Wait, What If podcast. This is an intro to last week's show. Well, we recorded this show last week. Me and Mike called Joe Hollis of Mountain Gardens Herbs out of, I want to say it's Asheville, but it's actually, he said, about an hour, hour and a half outside of Asheville on the side of a mountain. He's a interesting fella, to say the least. He lives on 3 to 4 acres of land that he bought almost 40 years ago. Actually, I think it is 40 years ago. Here in North Carolina, it's kind of where the everyone has a town in their state where they say keep it weird. Like in Texas, it was keep, I think it was keep Austin weird. And here it's keep Asheville weird. So it's like where all the neo-hippies and the old hippies kind of go and hang out. It's really nice, kind of laid back, if that's your thing. We'll just say it's an area that attracts alternative thinkers. So Joe Hollis, who is the owner of Mountain Gardens Herbs, so it throws you off there because the garden part is actually plural. Mountain Gardens Herbs. .com is actually the website. He's definitely one of those alternative thinkers. He's a naturalist, an amateur ethnobotanist. If you don't know what an ethnobotanist is, stay tuned for our interview and you learn all about that. He's also sort of an anarchist, which is interesting. Again, his views aren't my views, but you should realize that by now. I interview people of all sorts of views and who have all sorts of opinions on things. And the whole point of this podcast is to bring them on and learn about their ideas and learn about their different ways of living. And this guy definitely has a different way of living, and it's very interesting. In his talk, he refers to Gaia a lot. And Gaia, you have to Google it. It's the idea that Earth and everything that lives on Earth are all one being, all one organism. And I mean, this is like the rocks all the way up to the air that we breathe. It's kind of a far out idea, and I guess it extends into everything is interconnected. And he weighs heavily on this. Check out Mike's podcast, Make It a Double, on doublepodcast.com. He's got a bunch of new shows up. He's hitting it hard. He's been working hard on this podcast, and I think he does a really good job. Completely different sound than mine. His is well-produced music, and it's more like listening to NPR, and mine's more like listening to your inner monologue as you're trying to sleep at night. Make sure you're checking us out on Twitter at WWI Podcast, hashtag WWI Podcast. I've been trying to use that a lot. Check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/WWI Podcast, or of course, send us an email at waitwhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. So listen, and I hope you guys enjoy the show. And I apologize when you're listening. We kind of had a bad connection. Remember, I'm still trying to figure all this stuff out on this end. And there was some static, and there were some points of the interview where he was kind of hard to hear. But I cleaned it up the best I could, and I hope you enjoy the show.
You're listening to the Wait, What If podcast.
We're about to blow stuff up.
Say we were to walk out in the middle of the woods and find a 50-year-old moonshine bottle.
I think you could drink it.
I think I would drink it.
You know, his mom was probably really controlling and he wet the bed as a kid.
Reminds me of a strip club, actually.
Does it really?
Yeah, this is the champagne.
Ladies and gentlemen, make sure you put the money. Little.
I'm just going to eat this bacon and drink this whiskey.
Be prepared to expand your mind and question your reality. As always, your host, Kevin Sullivan.
Hello?
Hey, Joe. It's Kevin again. The big thing is going to be how well you can hear me, because we can hear you great. We have headphones on. As long as you can hear us, then we'll get started.
I think it's going to work, yeah.
All right, fantastic. So you're out in Asheville, right?
Northeast of Asheville, about an hour.
Ah, it's beautiful out there. How's your weather right now? Do you guys have any snow or anything?
Yeah, we got about a foot of snow. It's slowly melting. Quite a bit of it here, though.
All right, Joe. So if you don't mind, can you give me just a little bit of background? I looked at, you know, I've obviously been on your website. I've checked out your videos on YouTube. A lot of really, really cool, interesting stuff. But I couldn't find a lot, and maybe I just missed it, about, you know, where you grew up, things like that.
Okay, yeah, I don't think I put much of that on there. I grew up in Detroit.
Oh, okay.
So I know about snow as well.
You absolutely do.
And then I went with my family, drifted south, and ended up in Chapel Hill. My dad worked for the university down there.
Oh, okay.
That's where I graduated from. Having started college at the University of Detroit, I graduated from UNC in Chapel Hill.
Okay. What year was that?
1965.
Okay. What was your degree in?
It was history. It was my major, but towards the end, I was really switching more towards anthropology.
Okay.
If I had gone a little longer, it would have changed over.
That's actually... I was going to say that's right up my alley. I was a history major, too. Yeah, I went to University of New Hampshire. So,
okay, yeah.
So where did, I guess, give me a background on where the Paradise Garden came from. And
Well, then after I was in the Peace Corps, I drifted, I joined the Peace Corps. After I was graduated from college, I joined the Peace Corps because I was during the Vietnam War, and you kind of had to do something, either stay in school or so was alternative. So
yeah,
then
yeah.
I went off to Borneo, actually, for 3 years.
Borneo, the island, huh?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Isn't that...
It was pretty cool. Yeah, it was sort of tribal society, and I was traveling up and down the river, visiting these different villages, and looking at the schools, and I think that had a big effect on my thinking about life. You know, just seeing people who lived lives that were remarkably more simple than ours.
Sure, yeah.
But they didn't seem to be any less healthy or any less happy.
Sure.
Especially, you know, coming home, people always talk about culture shock, you know, coming home from third world thing and back to a U.S. mall or something. And it's pretty astounding.
Yeah, especially spending 3 years over there. That must have been a reintegration for yourself, trying to come back here in the United States, completely different.
Yeah, it took a while. I'm sure that had a big influence on my ideas. So.
Yeah.
And then so it was a period of the Vietnam War, and everybody's kind of questioning, you know, how we're living on Earth and so on. Or maybe they weren't. Really, people were just protesting against the government. But,
yeah.
You know, it seemed to me more that it's really all about our lifestyle. If we insist on having a certain lifestyle, then American imperialism goes along with that. And so why be out there protesting this way? And yeah, we got to like stomp all over everybody else in the world. Or we live a different way that doesn't imply, you know, that we have to be the empire and gathering resources from everywhere and so on. So kind of one of the direction I went into with my life is just to think about, I thought an interesting project would be to see if you could figure out a way to live on Earth that if everybody else lived the same way, we'd have kind of, ecological paradise and no war, peace, everybody be happy. Like, what kind of way to live would that be? So,
and this is...
I didn't have anything else to do with my life. I thought that's kind of a project I've undertaken.
And you've been, I read on there, you've been doing this for 40 years. So this is something that, I mean, you jumped right in and you stuck with it. Pretty much, it seems like, after the 60s, right? Or after you got back from Borneo?
Yeah, well, I ended up getting this land in 1972.
Okay.
So I came back in 69, and then I kind of spent some time thinking about going back to graduate school and becoming an anthropologist, and eventually decided I didn't want to do that, and then drifted down to North Carolina with some neighbors of mine, lived with them for a summer, and then got this piece of land. So, yeah, pretty much ding, ding, ding. So it was just a piece of woods, just 3 acres of woods, basically, at the foot of quite high mountains. It's right at the edge of the National Forest, actually. It's the end of the road. They're at the base of the Black Mountains. And so I've just been here working on this land ever since.
Yeah, I went to your website and I saw the cabin you have there and, you know, basically all the little buildings, yurts. It almost, if I could describe it a way, it reminds me of like The Hobbit, at least some of the buildings on the side of a mountain. These greenhouses, it's almost as if where you live has become or is part of the landscape versus going in and tearing down a landscape and just building, you know, a
condo. No, exactly. Yeah, well, that's a big part of it is, it's not just my ego acting out. It's sort of trying to be a dialogue with the piece of land that's here. And one way to do that is do everything by hand. And then everything takes a really long time. So you got a really long time to think about it before you do something stupid, like bring in a bulldozer and, you know, you can do incredible damage in an afternoon.
Sure.
So if you're doing it all with a shovel, you sort of figure out as you go along what's working, what's not, what's, you know, and you get your inspiration. It's really ideal.
Now, do you consider yourself an ethnobotanist?
I'm not a trained ethnobotanist, but I'm certainly an amateur ethnobotanist.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me what, and for the listeners too, what an ethnobotanist is? What and then again, I guess your utopian garden fantasy, which I think you called it once, your paradise garden. Explain the concept of that.
Well, those two big questions.
Yeah, I guess they are really big.
So botany is study of plants, of course. Ethno, if you put ethno in front of anything, how primitive people did it. So you get ethno-astronomy, ethno-zoology, ethno-botany, you know, like just...
So like the relationship of humans and plants.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. Especially in a more primitive context.
Sure.
Like not the relation of industry to plants, but tribal peoples and stuff. So how they used plants. What it did with them, because of course, up until, you know, the vast majority of human history or time humans have been on Earth, before we had history, which starts with writing, starts with agriculture, the Neolithic Revolution, right? Everything that we have written down is the history of us going off the path. You know, before that, we were on the path for like 2 million years. But now all we got is a record of going off the path, because it sort of happened simultaneously with writing. The paradise gardening idea, let's see, the big overall context would be that there's this superorganism called Gaia, and we're a part of it.
Okay.
So I would say all life on Earth is one single living creature.
Okay.
And it would even include the rocks and the air and the whole planet. You know, because the rocks actually generated the atmosphere. So the whole shebang is like one living organism, and we are a part of it. But then there's this competitor superorganism out there called civilization. And that's what we're all actually being a part of. So when we think about making a living, what we're really thinking about is how we're going to make money, which means how we're going to fit into civilization. Human superorganism that we've set up, which actually totally mimics the natural superorganism of Gaia. It's like this, you know, trophic pyramid of producers at the bottom and then sort of level consumers, herbivores, and then carnivores, and how that goes. And then with humans, it's the same kind of hierarchical structure, but we got peasants or workers on the bottom, and then we got the next layer up as managers or whatever. And then all the way up to the king or the president or whoever you want it, you know, it gets smaller and smaller. So we try to fit ourselves into that. But that thing, which I call civilization, that's this human hierarchical organization, as opposed to the first 2 million years, humans just were a part of Gaia. That's the only thing we fitted into. You know, we were in a little bands, 10 people, a dozen people. So a campfire, basically just making our living in relationship to the earth. But then with the development of agriculture and a surplus, and then you can have people taking different jobs, and then you can gradually develop this superorganism called civilization, which now we all try to fit ourselves into. But the big problem is that civilization is eating Gaia.
Mm-hmm.
Civilization has actually a cancer in the body. So if you think of Gaia as one huge living organism, then what happened is that this one species in there, which is Homo sapiens, just decided to set up shop for ourselves.
Right.
And decided that everything else was just raw materials. And we're just going to create our own little superorganism, right? We're just going to burn down everything. Like, it's just all raw materials. And we're going to get bigger and bigger and more diverse. So we get, so civilization gets more and more diverse by means of precisely exactly lowering the diversity of nature. So you can cut everything down, you know, and then grow where there was a rainforest, you can cut it all down and then have some cows and, you know, and then you send it all back to McDonald's and you've got this whole, all these jobs created.
Yeah. If I can interject here for a quick second, the one thing that I look at, I work in medicine, I'm a physician assistant, a PA, and my patients come in and the first thing I tell them, or what I try to tell them, and I have it actually, I have whiteboards in my office or in my exam rooms, and I draw a picture of a caveman, and then I draw a line, and then I have another stick figure, but it's a round one, you know, showing obesity. And I tell them, I said, you know, if we lived more like our ancestors, you know, not 75 years ago, but say 150,000 years ago, a lot of the things that we deal with now, diabetes, joint disease, stress, any depression, anxiety, can be eliminated. Sure. Yep. It's just trying.
Well, that's one of the slim hopes we have for human survival is that we wake up to the fact that not only are we killing the earth, but we're killing ourselves at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And it's
exactly simultaneous.
Sure. And I always tell people too, you know, being, I'm Western trained, Western medicine, and I believe a lot in it, but I also understand the Eastern philosophy and the idea of, you know, preventative medicine and living well. But what I like to mention about all this is that, yes, we have Western medicine, but Western medicine, it treats and it can cure Western diseases. So a lot of the disease states that we have, your diabetics, your high blood pressure, all these things, we have the medicine that fixes it, but it's almost like you're just putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound, you know? You're saying, we can bring this down, but if you continue living this lifestyle that's really, it's not how humans are meant to live. We're not meant to, the stress that people go through, the stuff they're putting in their bodies is just not how we're designed. It's a vast, vast change from hundreds of thousands of years to just try to do that in 75 years, and we're seeing the results of it. And the result of it is misery. I mean, someone with diabetes and high blood pressure or cancer, it's a miserable thing.
Yeah, well, we're totally programmed. You know, we come into, we're born already programmed.
Right.
Like you bring home a laptop, it's programmed.
Yeah.
We're born programmed to live in Gaia.
Okay.
But instead, we don't get that. I mean, I think this is the root cause of autism, probably. A certain amount of kids, the gap between what they were born expecting to do and what the reality is just overcomes them.
Mm-hmm.
But most of us, you know, they start programming us from the day we're born, programming us to be in civilization.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's not what we're meant to do. We're meant to, for one thing, we're meant to be walking continually. You just look at a human being, we're half legs, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the most healthy exercise that we can possibly do, walking.
Absolutely.
And it's also like there's an endless number of scientists, philosophers, artists, whatever, who attest that all their inspiration comes when walking. You know, there's huge lists of people who attribute everything to walking. That's what we are. We're the creature that walks around and looks at everything mm-hmm. and keeps it all in order. What's called the keystone species.
Uh-huh. And it's
very
funny.
It's an important ecological niche for us, even higher than wolves, like up there with bears and eagles and so on.
It's funny. They did a study. One of the most effective ways, and I'm one who does this. I like to take people off of medicines. I try to get them better and take them off. But walking 35, 45 minutes a day, that's all you have to do as your first line for bringing down high blood pressure. So if you can get everyone just to go out and just walk, you can limit so much disability. People.
You can also deal with big, major issues of trauma and mental trauma by thinking about them while walking. It balances the left and right parts of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So if you visualize like traumatic incidents in your life while you're walking,
sure,
it can really square it up for you. Yeah, so it's kind of because so that's just like one little example of how we are born, you know, to exercise this certain role, and it's good for us and it's good for the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just like any cell in my body. What's good for it is what's good for me.
Yeah,
has to be that way.
Sure.
It can't be that what's good for me is bad for it. That's impossible, or vice versa. So by, you know, the very measure of how much we're screwing up the planet is just that much that we're screwing up ourselves. So the idea of the Paradise Garden is to get us back where we're supposed to be, you know, try and get back integrated into, you know, having our life support system depend directly on the planet,
mm-hmm.
which is seems really far-fetched. And then again, you know, 100 years ago, there was people living right here in these mountains who were like 99% self-reliant.
That's right.
Living up there. Now, we could quarrel with how good or bad a job they were doing,
yeah.
but they were doing it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Think about what are basic human needs. They all have to be things that we can get directly from the planet because we evolved them. We can't have a basic human need for a smartphone.
No. And it's, you know, and you can see it, including myself. I grew my first garden last year. You know, I'm trying. And it was all trial and error and trying different things and, you know, working with the soils and stuff like that. But as, and I'm 39 years old. So as a child of the 70s and 80s, or basically representing my generation, there's a disconnect, a vast disconnect to gardening, to foods, to plants, to the earth, and what we do in our daily life. I mean, you can go to the store and buy a piece of chicken, and it doesn't even look like chicken. There's no skin on it. There's no feathers. It's just a lump of meat. And that disconnect, I think, has a lot of issues with society, especially with self-reliance. You know, I think, you know, whether someone eats meat or not, I think going out and taking down an elk and preparing it and cooking it and understanding, you know, the chain that brings you together with the food is extremely important. Because when people had that and when they knew about it, well, first of all, things like eating, we didn't take for granted because you had to go out and get your food. And then preparing it, you didn't take for granted because you had to prepare it right or you were going to get sick or you were going to lose it and everyone was going to starve. I mean, the consequences 100 years ago plus, you know, on were much greater than they are today. What do you think, or where do you think society can go to, I guess, reintegrate children or individuals, really, back into nature and back into how we are meant to live and how we are meant to...
Well, there's a lot going on, you know, there's a lot going on. There's all this, basically, this whole concept of earth skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's you can spend the entire year going from one earth skills gathering to another.
I never heard of that. Where does someone find something like that?
Well, in the winter they tend to be down in Florida.
Okay.
Down south, and then there's some big ones around Asheville. Then there's of course the Rainbow Gathering itself, which has this green tribe as part of it. No botanists teaching each other earth skills. And earth skills is just like how primitive people lived on Earth. You know, what to do with road kills, a lot about wild plant identification.
Mm-hmm.
And they get into tanning hides and, you know, making tools and baskets and a million things, just kind of primitive skills. So there's all that going on. Then there's also, like, quite a large resurgence of the back-to-the-land thing, which is kind of ebbing and flowing ever since America was founded, really. There's a good book on the alternations of the back-to-the-land movement. There's been about 20 of them in America since the Puritans. Every
really?
Time the economy tanks a little bit, it's back to the land.
Well, people realize
that the Depression was a big back-to-the-land movement.
Yeah, they realize they can't rely on you know, the grocery stores being
sure,
stocked
yeah.
and having
the fallacies are exposed. There's a lot of that going on now. That's the whole ASAP. You see their literature around Nashville. They're promoting Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project, it's called. And they've got this big book they put for local foods. I mean, there must be 500 little farms, you know, young sure. couple starting off buying a piece of land, growing some crop, blueberries or honey or wheat or medicinal herbs or the whole CSA farmers market thing. So there's quite a lot going on. I don't know that a lot of people are as focused as I am on this whole underlying philosophy of the thing, but there's a lot of people that really have a kind of gut level understand that they want to be closer to the earth, that they want to make a living, you know, interacting with the earth some way or another. Asheville's a hotbed of medicinal herbalism, which is kind of a specialty of mine. There's like 4 or 5 herb schools in Asheville, which is a lot for a town that size.
Are you familiar at all? And this is coming from a person who I deal with patients all the time, and I'm always looking at what are ways that people can make themselves healthier and stuff. Are you familiar with ayahuasca?
Sure. Yes, certainly. I grow it.
Do you really? What now? That alone is fascinating to me. Unbelievably fascinating. Two plants that really don't have anything in common with each other. They're purgatory. At least one of them is purgatory, meaning you take it and you purge. You're vomiting and diarrhea and whatever. And then the other one is the ayahuasca vine. You combine them together, and it makes this drink that basically. I don't even know. I mean, I've never done it, but from what I read is most everyone who does has a very same and very similar journey into a almost like a I don't know. Can you describe it for me? I've just been reading about it, and I've been really interested in talking to someone who knows about it and can explain it a little bit more.
No, I've never done any ayahuasca, but it comes through Asheville periodically, I'm told. There's shamans who come up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got, you know, you just need to ask around and you can participate.
What it does...
Like I say, I grow it, but I've never taken ayahuasca. I've taken peyote and things like that.
Yeah.
It's very holistic. I expect it's a similar...
Have you ever
read... Experience of feeling oneness with the universe and so on.
Sure.
Psilocybin, very similar.
Yeah. And what's and funny about...
all sacraments that people use.
Mm-hmm. The psilocybin, are you familiar with McKenna and, I mean, you grew up in that that age.
I've read McKenna's book.
Yeah.
Food for the Gods.
And the chemicals that these, they're all very similar, and they all have theories that perhaps, you know, these are here and meant for us to see and to find so we can have that introspective and see how everything is kind of connected I guess on a level or in a realm that we don't understand here on this on the surface.
Perspective. It's interesting to speculate on how, especially down in the Amazon, where people really specialized in psychedelic plants.
Sure.
There are other places in the world too, but in the Amazon, they got really into it and they figured out, like I said, these combinations of a MAO inhibitor and a DMT plant. You can't.
That's right.
There's a lot of DMT plants, but they won't get you high because it won't get into your brain unless you have a MAO inhibitor.
That's right.
With it.
Yeah,
so they figured that out. And how'd they figure it out? Well, they say they figured it out by talking to the plant.
That's right, yeah.
Which is another whole aspect of this whole question, which is, see, I feel like every creature on Earth is enlightened except human beings. Like, they all know that they're part of the whole. Like, they spend all day, bears and chipmunks and worms and, you know, nematodes and amoebas. Like, they spend all day basking in the knowledge that they're one part, they're doing their part, and they're part of the whole thing. And we're the only ones that have forgotten.
Well, it's
and that's
consciousness.
Why we're screwing everything up.
We're the
Even these more primitive people, they can still talk to the plants. You ask them how they know that, how they discovered the medicinal virtues of these herbs, they say, we learned it from the plants.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I guess if you think of people who, it's their environment, you know, and that goes back to what you're saying. You know, I can pick up a book and read about it, or I can go outside and try to find a certain plant. But these people, that is their backyard. That is their living room. That's their bed. They're amongst these trees and animals, and they have to.
The whole, like, thing of shamanism, you know, what's a shaman? A person who can, you know, deal and move into that world of nature and Gaia and communicating to what's going on a whole other spiritual level. So that's what all those psychoactive plants are like gifts. I think they're the most important plants on Earth, really. Insane that we've made them all illegal.
I think McKenna said, yeah, isn't that crazy too? Alcohol, which is basically a poison. You can go out and you turn 21, here you go, kid. Drink as much as you want. But something that's natural, just grows out of the ground. Nope, you can't go near that, which, you know, I think pot and all those things, there's no one ever said.
Well, it's because civilization has an intelligence of its own, and it recognizes its enemies.
Okay. I never looked at it that way, but I guess I understand when you hear that something that is natural is banned, but something like alcohol isn't, you see the whole political side of it. And that's interesting in and of itself, and that kind of leads me into another question here I had. There's a symbiotic relationship, I think, with humans and plants. I mean, it's obvious. They filter the CO2 out of the air, you know. They give us medicines. They supply us with fibers for clothes and gosh, I mean, we can breathe the air that's filtered through the plants. The energy from the sun comes down into the plants. We have developed the enzymes to break some of these down, to break the medicines down. It's I guess a product of a long evolutionary type of symbiosis, or, you know, in more of the metaphysical way, it could be something else. So I guess what I'm getting at there is, did we adapt to this environment, or are we part of this environment together?
Well, see, I think it's all, like I said, I think it's all a single living organism, just like you think of yourself as a single living organism, because you started from one fertilized cell in your mother's womb, you know, and then it just kept multiplying, and then you popped out, and then you got bigger and bigger, you know, but you're still one thing the whole way along, right?
That's right.
So every little cell in your body, a blood cell or a bone cell or a skin cell or whatever, is participating in the whole you-ness of you. It's doing its little job, you know, and it's helping the whole thing to work. And when you're happy, it's happy. And if it screws up, then it's bad news for you. And so I just see the Earth as the same thing on a bigger scale, that we are part of it. So we grew up along with it. We've been we're all immortal. Like, here's the interesting insight. Everything that's out there that's alive, grass and worms and birds and whatever, we're all the same age, right? Because we all were born when life started on Earth.
That's great. Well, actually, when
extinct, tons and tons of stuff went extinct, but everything was left.
It's still here.
We've been there. We've been going along the whole damn time, the whole way through history. You and me and this poplar tree and the grass, like we've traveled all that distance together the whole time.
And you can even say all the way back, all the way back to the Big Bang, because all the matter that's here has been there. You know?
That's right. Yeah, there's no reason to restrict it to planet Earth. You might as well, if you go that far, then you might as well say the whole universe is one single living organism.
Sure.
Which I'm perfectly happy doing. That would account for why there might be some truth in astrology and so on. But anyway, yeah, so of course we fit, you know, because we fitted since day one.
Yeah,
we absolutely never didn't fit.
That's
until
true.
Until finally the origins of agriculture, and we start off on this civilization kick, and that's when we kind of drift off into not fitting. It's just really a pretty short time. That's like 5,000 years or something like that. An eye blink, really, that we've gotten off track.
Yeah. Hey, my co-host, he had to come in a little bit late, but my co-host, Mike Stojic, is here. Mike, do you want to say hi to Joe?
Hey, Joe, how are you? I'm sorry I was a little bit late.
No problem.
Yeah, but I did get a chance to listen to quite a bit of what you were saying as I snuck in and was trying to catch up. And I'm kind of curious, is your idea to live in a world that takes us all the way back to, I guess, more or less the hunter-gatherer days? Or do you think that because we have this technology, and I think we are getting a little bit better with it, that perhaps we can use the technology to live in harmony with the Earth and Gaia?
Well, we can't go back to the hunter-gatherer days because we got too many people on Earth. Even if we wanted to do that, which is unlikely that very many people would, there's just the carrying capacity of the Earth for a hunter-gatherer is like one person per square mile or something like that. So that's out of the question. When you talk about using modern technology, on the other hand, that's implying that we're going to keep civilization in place. And like I said, civilization is the problem. Civilization is pretty much destroying the earth in order to deliver us stuff like a smartphone, you know. The amount of electricity being gobbled up to keep the internet going, I mean, it's just staggering. You know, nobody wants to look at that question, but just staggering the amount of fossil fuels that have to be burnt so that you can look at your smartphone and be connected with the whole earth. So we've got to evolve away from that. So what we need to do is start from where we are and get a clear idea where we want to get to, and then start down this road, you know, just step by step, discarding stuff that we don't really need, because we know that everything that we really need is available to us from a direct relationship with the earth. We don't need any technology at all to meet any genuine human need. It's just a whole lot of wants that we've set up for ourselves. So we've set up a situation where most of the most brilliant brains on this planet are spending most of their time inventing things that we have to have. You know, they're creating wants for us all the time, and they'll never stop. Like, I'm fond of saying that if we could be content with what our grandparents would have been thrilled to have, we could have peace on Earth right now. But we can't be content with what our grandparents would have been thrilled to have. They didn't have, like, an automobile. They didn't have the Internet. They didn't have computers. We couldn't live without that shit, except we really could, and we know we could. But we're stuck with it. Like, so we just got to work our way out of it, right?
Yeah, I guess you could have made the same argument for our grandparents, though. My grandparents actually had automobiles because I'm only 30.
Yeah, well, mine, yeah, all right, great-grandparents.
But they could have made the same argument about their grandparents, about getting back to the horse and buggy and those sorts of things. But I think there's something to be said about technology that makes life a little bit more efficient. And then also, when we talk about needs, yeah, I guess basic needs of survival, really food and shelter, that's really all you need, and water. But then Maslow and his hierarchy of needs goes into something a bit different when we start talking about as we evolve as a species and we begin to appreciate things like art. So there's music, there's paintings, there's dance, and there's all these different expressions of humanity.
But I'm saying technology
evolves, or art evolves with technology. So I think with these hierarchy of needs, we come to appreciate things. I think technology, there's beauty in some technology, and I agree that, you know, fossil fuels and that sort of thing is destroying the earth. But then there's something really interesting happening now with sustainable energy and harnessing the energy of the sun and harnessing the energy of wind with giant wind turbines. And then I know there's some really neat things out in California where they put these I don't know what it is, but somehow they put this stuff out into the ocean and it's able to harness the energy of like waves, and that's all sustainable energy, which will power that smartphone that you were talking about. And I think as we begin to evolve and our technology begins to evolve, we can pull away from some of this fossil fuel technology. And then I think our technology, the iPads and the iPods and the iPhones, can live in harmony with the earth, and we can still be efficient as people and still have this sort of connection with Gaia, but then also with this, you know, the efficiency that technology grants us. I don't know. I'm just interested in your thoughts.
Well, I hope you're right. I mean, that's what everybody's hoping for, of course.
And, right.
And I'm exploring a different frontier because part of what I'm interested in is not just saving the earth, but saving myself. So, So the argument cuts. The other side of the argument is that by spending our lives in pursuit of money, we're destroying ourselves. So that's what civilization is about. So the way you fit into civilization is you make money. So then you have to become a partial human being, because you have to have a specialty. Like, you're either going to be a strong back, or you're going to be, you know, like some of us who are lucky might manage to make money by being clever or artistic. 90% of people are going to make their money by just wearing out their bodies, you know?
Sure.
Or sitting in a cubicle all day, or it's like some shit job. So everybody comes a partial human being, so that civilization can be the whole human being. So everybody's spending 9 to 5, you know, 40 hours a week for the best 40 years of their life doing some little thing, whereas in fact, that's just one part of being a whole human. And then you get money, and then you run around with money and satisfy your needs. So you go to the grocery store, and you go to a gym, and you go out for entertainment, you go to a movie, you go rent some studio space to be creative, you go to church, you know, you're running all around with your money, satisfying your different needs. Whereas the original situation, when you were a human being immersed in Gaia, is all your needs were satisfied by just going out there in the morning and walking around. You were getting your exercise, your inspiration, like my paradise garden. I get up in the morning, I go out there, I'm getting my exercise, I'm being creative, I'm being inspired by being in a beautiful environment, I'm gathering food, there's my medicinal herbs, you know, I'm doing my part for the earth, whatever, like all my needs are integrated, right? So that's the other side of the argument is one way to look at it is, well, there's three ways to look at it, really. The way we're living now, what's it doing to us? What's it doing to the planet? And what's it doing to our species? So one thing that's built into civilization is it's a hierarchical arrangement of human beings. So we're not all going to be equals. Some people are going to be at the top, given the orders. Some people are going to be at the bottom, taking the orders. Some people are going to be rich. Some people are going to be poor. Inequality is built into the whole situation, and from equality follows warfare. And we've got better and better weapons now. You know, we have not only nuclear weapons, but now we can start screwing around with genes. So chemical warfare, biological warfare is all right on the horizon. That's another aspect of this civilization cancer thing, is that all human beings are unequal and in a state of war with each other, competing for status. Like, why do we have to consume so much? Because what we have shows our status in civilization. You know, if I got a beat up 92 Chevy, I'm shit. And if I've got a, you know, brand new Mercedes, then I'm like up there. It's all just like so much of what we consume is just symbolic stuff. There's nothing to do with basic human needs. We're way beyond that. The demands we're making on the planet.
Curiously, I'm wondering, have you ever read Fight Club by Chuck Palahniuk?
No, my son keeps getting after me to read that book. Does that relate?
You are basically repeating the basis of what that book is about. People, what he says, being filed away in 40-story filing cabinets, you know, being their apartments and their jobs and stuff. And what the term Fight Club comes down to, they get together and they literally fight. But the idea there is you can't fake it. You know, if you are going knuckle to knuckle with another person for the enjoyment of it, you both are, you know, in there together. There's no one's injuring someone else without their consent. But the idea is if you go and you do that, so I think our life, we numb ourselves and we kind of pass our time with distractions, right? Movies, TV, new toys, whatever it is, it distracts us from the actual point of living. You don't feel pain. You try not to feel pain. You try not to feel anger. You try to ignore all those things and step in line. You know, get your new pants, get your new job, get your new car. And the basis of this book is when they're fighting, all that means nothing. The only thing that means anything is the moment that you're there. You can't fake it. You have to face your fears, face your pain. And of course, it's all symbolic about, you know, life and all that. But that's the basis of the book.
Yeah, well, like I said, you know, you could do it for the sake of the earth, or you could do it for the sake of peace on earth. Like, mm-hmm. I make a point of trying to live within the limits of what, if we divided up all the resources on earth and everybody got an equal share.
Yeah.
To try and live within that. So, you know, I'm on a couple acres of land, which there's enough land on earth to have everybody have a couple acres.
Sure, yeah. There's actually enough land in Texas for everyone to have 1,000 square feet Every single living person on Earth have 1,000 square feet in Texas. Puts things into perspective, doesn't it?
I got my income down around, $6,000 or $7,000 a year. Really, I'm almost self-reliant here.
Yeah, that's pretty much
but
it.
I do have to have a car, and I do keep the internet going. And
yeah.
Yeah, I think these tools are handy, but I think we don't really need them, and we can work our way out of them. But, mm-hmm. We don't. That doesn't have to be a big thing. Everybody can go at their own pace. But, yeah, so that's one motivation. But the other motivation is just to do it for your own self. I get up in the morning, and I just decide what I want to do for the day.
So
not very many people are so fortunate as to just get up in the morning and have 50 things that they all really want to do to choose between. And get up when they feel like it and go to bed when I feel like it. And, I'm not on anybody else's schedule.
So, I mean, I think that you're lucky. I think how many folks do you have living in the Paradise Garden?
Here at Mountain Gardens?
Yes.
Let's see. At the moment, there are three people here. Two of them have been. Jeff has been here for about 3 years, but mostly it's apprentices coming and going.
Oh, okay.
And they mostly are here between March and October, and I usually have 6 or 7 or 8 people here through the summer helping out. I'd like to have more people stay for longer. Sometimes people stay for 2 years or 3 years, and that's great.
Oh, okay.
They get more. The more they know the ropes, the more helpful sure. they are.
So you get more and more people showing up, and then what happens if another, let's say, Paradise Garden 2.0 opens up maybe a mile or two down the road, and they, it's not, I don't know if it's civilization, I think it may just be human nature, but things like jealousy and greed and envy and desire and those things start to take over. And would you be concerned that there may be issues? Do you think you could live in harmony with Paradise Garden 2.0, or do you think that perhaps would you be worried?
Well, my vision of life on Earth would be that everybody was, that all human beings are little cells of Paradise Gardens, all packed together, little groups of 6 or 8 or 10, or some people might like to live in bigger groups of 50 people or, we'd just all be taking care of the Earth and getting our living 90% of our needs met from our direct relationship with our planet. That's a very, very far-fetched vision. But really, no crazier than thinking that the government's going to solve our problems.
I definitely don't think the government's
really
going to solve
them. Think that.
Nope, cannot solve the problems.
No, they're the biggest. They're the biggest problem. I definitely agree with that. But has there ever been a time when only 6 to 8 people have ever lived together? I think generally we're designed. I remember reading, and I think there's a documentary on it talking about, what size society people are best suited for. And I think it was 150.
That was number sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the number. That so we're familiar with up to 150 people, and that's what we're able to work with comfortably or in harmony with.
Okay, I like this guy, but he's coming back to the Pleistocene. He's basically talking about a group of people small enough to sit around a campfire together, which is your basic hunter-gatherer band.
Mm-hmm.
But how would you sustain the race then? I mean, if you only have 6 to 8 people, and let's say 8 people, and 4 are girls and 4 are boys, and they can procreate, but then at some point there's gene pool issues, and you know what I mean. And then
that's silly. I'm not trying to invent the future. I'm trying to talk about how we should be living in this lifetime.
But
like the next generation can invent their generation themselves.
You're talking for 60, 70 years.
I'm talking about what the situation we're in right now.
What kind of time frame?
Alarm bells should be going off for the human species right now.
I think there is. I mean, there's a big push.
Yeah. So how should we live now? I mean, there's no way we can say I'm going to design this way to live that's going to be good for the next million years. All I can see is I can see far enough ahead to know where I should be going in this lifetime, and the next lifetime they'll work. They'll figure it out from there.
Well, do you not think that we should...
But in terms of your original question of, like, there's eight people living here, are they going to breed with each other? Well, no, they're going to... I mean, I got four girls and four guys, and there's guys and girls showing up all the time wanting to take them out.
Right, and then you want to, like... And that's how these little civilizations or societies get bigger. They're no longer six to eight people or enough to sit around the campfire. They become 16, and then 16 becomes 32, and 32 becomes 64.
You just have a bunch of eights next to each other.
So a bunch
of
eights.
They don't have to merge into 16s and 32s. They could just be a bunch of little cells, like my body, you know, as a bunch of cells next to each other.
It's kind of like our neighborhood.
They're glomming together into bigger cells. They're staying nice and comfortably right next to each other.
No, that sounds like a lot like my neighborhood. We have a bunch of houses and families live in them, and there's some houses have four people, some have up to six, you know, because there's a mom and a dad and some kids. So I guess that's like a lot of little cells living next to each other in our neighborhood.
Well, I'm just thinking of the size unit of people that can work together, because, you know, what we're talking about is meeting our needs from a direct relationship with Earth, right? So we're talking about making a garden and growing enough food for us all to eat. And then at the same time, we want to make it the most beautiful place on Earth, so we don't really want to go anywhere else. We just want to spend our time there and,
but I guess,
you know, exploring and so on. So, you know, you could do that with varying scales of size, but since I happen to buy 4 acres of land and eight people fits on it, that's what I'm doing.
No,
like I said, other people might prefer, like there's this community down the road, Earth Haven. I think they got like 500 acres and they got 200 people there or something like that. That's okay.
Well, it works. What works for you doesn't necessarily need to work for someone else, and what works for someone else doesn't necessarily have to work for you, as long as you're taking care of the Earth at the end of the and yourselves, obviously, at the end of the day.
Yep, that's
probably the most
the whole
important
goal,
thing.
Is to, like,
but
quit making these.
I do have a question, though, because you said what works for you now, and, you know, we don't, you know, what works for the next generation doesn't really matter, but I kind of think it does, and I'm just kind of curious, don't you think what we do today in our generation, in our lifetime, certainly does have a huge effect on those who come after us? I mean, we're essentially laying... We're creating the groundwork for those who come after us. So I think in some regards we do need to consider how the next generation is going to...
So what we need to do is just keep moving ourselves that much closer to what I call paradise, which is back to a point where we were living in a sustainable relationship with the planet.
Sure.
But as far as, like, you know, setting it up like this is going to be the rules of how we're all going to live, you know, and you guys are going to be stuck with it because I invented it. Just as long as we keep our eye on the big picture, which is like we just got to quit abusing the planet and using more resources than we're entitled to, and which is like having disastrous effects on the whole third world. And we're all aware of that, you know, that Americans are consuming, you know, 80% of the Earth's resources or some shit. I forget how much. So just 80. As long as we're trying to get ourselves out of those two really serious ethical compromises that we're in.
I feel like the Chinese have got to be worse than Americans, right? 'Cause actually, I think I've read that third world developing countries are actually using more energy and doing more harm to the planet because they're living in the industrial age, which was creating more pollution than any other age. We're actually getting better with some of the technology.
Well, the whole third
energy.
World is colonized by us. You know, when we're burning down Indonesia to Indonesian rainforest to put in oil palm. You can say that's the third world fucking it up, but it's not. It's us fucking it up.
Yeah,
because we're creating that demand for that oil palm because we want to have this feel-good biodiesel for ourselves. I mean, we've set up the situation.
Joe, I got a quick question for you because about six, seven months ago, I got into meditation, and I do that pretty regularly now. And then I think maybe about a month ago, I got into yoga because it helps with, I guess, I don't know, get you more in tune with your body, and it's a spiritual thing if you're doing it right. And I was just kind of curious, do you do anything like that? Do you consider yourself very spiritual? Or Just kind of, I'd just like to hear your thoughts.
I'm very much of a Taoist, if you know what Taoism is. It's like an ancient Chinese religion.
Mm-hmm.
Tao Te Ching and so on. So, but I don't really have a lot of practice in terms of, they're the ones that invented Tai Chi, Qigong, and those kind of exercises. I go to some yoga workshops a friend of mine teaches from time to time, but no, I wish I did more of that sort of thing, but I don't. I have other practices that I do
like
along those lines, trying to integrate myself into the unity of the universe.
Is it anything that the rest of us could maybe look into, or is it sort of your own thing that you've discovered and evolved?
It's just my way of life.
Okay, got it. Right.
My way of life. Like, I spend a lot of time walking, you know, I live on the edge of the woods. I spend a lot of time outdoors in nature, and the things I do all day long, like, that's my spiritual exercises, kind of. So it's all integrated into everything else that I do all day long.
I think basically, Joe, I understand where you're coming from. The fundamental of it is that we are designed a certain way, you know, obviously to walk in our bare feet, to live off the land. There's a, you know, if we consider ourselves little pink monkeys, then there's certain ways little pink monkeys can live and keep the earth the way it is. Technology, time, all that has created, things that have been, it's kind of a double-edged sword. You know, they've done things like connected people where they otherwise wouldn't have been connected, and ideas can be spread, you know, with printed paper and with boats and aircraft and things like that.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how important any of that really is, but go ahead.
It all depends on how you look at it. What I'm saying is I understand, you know, where you're coming from, but it's also, I don't think there's any going back. And I think to look forward, we have to say, all right, what are the good things that come out of this? All right. Well, Joe, I really, really appreciate you taking your time out and talking to us. My whole goal of this podcast is to, like I said before, it's just to open people's eyes to say, hey, you know, and I know it's kind of ironic that I'm using social media or something like this to try to get people away from social media, but the idea is to change people's perspectives, to kind of understand the world around us and to, you know, hear from people like yourself where otherwise, you know, my listeners aren't going to go out into Asheville and talk to you. Maybe they will, but, you know, the majority of them won't. So this is kind of a neat way that different messages can get across.
Well, good. Well, I certainly appreciate it.
Hey, no problem, Joe.
Opportunity.
All right, Joe. Well, thanks again, and yeah, look out for my email. I'll shoot a line. It usually takes me a few days to get this stuff together, but who knows if I'm in Asheville, maybe I'll look you up and see that Paradise Garden.
Yeah, where do you live, by the way?
I'm out in Clayton, just south of Raleigh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
We get up in the mountains. That'd be cool.
All right.
Okay. Well, right. Thanks for your work.
All right. Appreciate take care. It. All right. Bye bye. All right, Mike, let's continue this conversation just for a few minutes.
All right.
All right, hold on a minute.
I agree with a lot of it, and then I disagree with, obviously, some of it, I think.
So let me, I guess, I understand for the listeners, all right, you know, the purpose of this is to get other people's perspective on life, and I understand where...
Get us thinking.
Yeah, and I understand where he's coming from, and I think he... just represents an extreme of one side of things, because personally I mean we need, all right, there's the idealistic way of saying if we all just lived in our own paradise garden, life would be great, and that's true, it would, because you wouldn't have to worry about mortgages and you wouldn't have to worry about things, right? You just wake up and you do your thing for the day.
Yeah, but you, instead of mortgages and, you know, all the other silly things that go along with life, you'd worry about other things like where your next meal is coming from.
Yeah, and feeding your kids,
or
and
not getting
sure,
attacked by bears in the middle of the night.
There's a I'm not gonna remember the name of it. There's a documentary about a guy who lives I think he's the most northernmost American. He lives on the Arctic Circle up in...
Well, you can do it. And I think, well, you know, Joe even mentioned it. You know, he's like, in today's world, it's not possible to do the Paradise Garden concept for everyone on the planet. It's just not sustainable.
Yeah.
Because there's so many people, you almost have to have... He didn't say this, but I mean, essentially, you almost have to have processed food, and you have to process everything else. And even,
well, there's so many people, and there's
Neil Tyson deGrasse. He even mentions Neil
deGrasse Tyson.
Neil deGrasse Tyson. Whatever.
deGrasse Tyson.
Too many names.
Just say Neil. Just say Dr. Tyson.
So we all know Dr. Tyson. And, he had a great show called The Cosmos, which I really enjoyed, and I'm upset that there's not more than one season. Anywho, but he even mentions, like, hey, genetically modified foods, that's, we have to accept that. I mean, that's the way the, how else are you going to feed everyone?
And
but I think he brings up some good points. Like, I think it's just responsible for people to get back to some sort of quality of, you know, living in harmony with the earth and appreciating the earth and everything it has to offer, and to understand that what we're doing is destroying the earth. And, you know, to take technology, and we're advanced enough now to use it to actually help benefit the earth and maybe reverse some of the damages we've done in the past. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think there's any reason why we can't live in harmony with technology.
Well, I think, and I agree with that. And I think, not just agree with it, I think that's how it has to work, because unless you pull the plug, I mean, that's so, but I think, as a society, we need people like Joe to remind us that,
yes,
that it, when you break it down to the basics, we are just humans. I mean, we're just these pink monkeys or naked apes, I think they call us. That's the term I think Graham Hancock used or somebody used. But the idea is, we have basic needs, and that a lot of the stresses and a lot of the worries and a lot of the problems in the world come from society. Now, you can't get rid of society. We're social, and I think one thing he didn't touch on is that we're social animals. I mean, that's how we interact. That's why you would sit around a campfire with eight people, because we can't survive on our own. And just the way that society kind of grew, and we went from the campfire to the village, from the village to the state, you know, from the state to the country, it's just kind of natural progression of things. And I think a lot of the stuff that you see, like, you have you know, Muslims war on the West, and the West democracy and communism, you have all these different ideologies that fight against each other. That's just a example. It's, you know how they say microcosm, you look at a small thing and it explains a big thing. Well, that's a big thing that is just a representative of the small thing. All those big ideals, or all those big fundamentals that people argue over and go into war over, I think can be broken down to the individual. So I think it's just a large representation on how human beings are, and I don't think you can do anything about it. I mean, I think that's just who we are. We're apes. When it comes down to it, we just want to propagate the species. And if you get in my way of propagating, then I'm going to club you over the head. And then you go beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, there's also things like greed and envy and jealousy and desire and those things that kind of get in the way too. And I don't know if that necessarily has to do with propagating the species. I mean, if you have something really nice, it's kind of like, why don't I have something very nice? Why can't I have something as nice as you? And it's like, well, you work a little bit harder than I do, so that's why you have nicer things.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean I'm perhaps not jealous or greedy or envious of it, and I don't
and
do terrible things to you in order to get it. I mean, that explains a lot of crime.
There's evolutionary principles, I think, to it too.
Yeah, sure, for sure.
You know, greed, you know, the one who killed more deer and kept more of the meat, I guess, survived, right? So you got that in you to...
And then the guy who did that also, not only greed, but the guy who was able to... was a skillful hunter and was able to kill more deer, he didn't have to do other things like plant vegetables and fruits. You know, he could trade that meat for the vegetable and the fruits. And the fruit guy knew that he was good at doing those sorts of things, and he could trade those fruits and vegetables for meat.
And then, now we've got capitalism and society. Right. Yeah, so, it's just the way it works.
I mean, it was just, that's where it comes from. So one guy's not going to do it all because he doesn't have enough time in the day to do it. So one guy gets really good at hunting, and the other guy gets really good at gathering, or the other guy gets really good at, you know, farming or whatever the case is. And you trade. And then somebody was like, you know, instead of trading this for that, let's create some sort of money that we can exchange for goods and services instead of bartering, which is, I guess, the way it was back then. So, I mean, money's not – money in and of itself isn't bad. It's just what you choose to do with that money.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, money can do a lot of really great things in the world. I don't think that's the problem. Yeah, but that in the that was the birth of capitalism. Mm-hmm. That's what inevitably led to money.
And, you know, like I said, I mean, and he might not think it because he's lived like this for 40 years, but I think, you know, it's an extreme. Oh, I think, I mean, it is an extreme to be able to live on $6,000 a year. And that, I mean, it would be great. Don't get me wrong. I think a lot of people would love to be, it sounds like he's very stress-free, but you know, I mean, the reality is this is the world that we were born into. And,
we make the most of it. I think it's extremely important now that our generation and the generation that comes after next appreciates, and it's what I said before, the damage that we're doing to the planet, and we actually use technology in order to sustain life instead of destroy it.
Sure.
You know, he talked about just tearing down the rainforest. And, you know, I thought when he said, you know, I have to go out with a shovel and clear the land and build a home on it, and it takes a long time to do. And it's like, well, you know, our development has been growing extremely quickly. And
yeah,
it takes a week to put the foundation down for a house, and then
bam,
day. I literally took one day to build the walls of the first floor of a house.
And next then, like,
the second day, yeah, was the second floor. And
yeah,
it's like, geez, how quickly are
well,
they
how about
moving?
This? It was like August. I used to look out my window, and it was all trees next door. And now there's a house, you know, 30 feet from mine, and there's a whole family living there.
It's only like, been
wow.
a few months. It's absolutely incredible. Yeah. But you're right. You absolutely lose perspective and
sure.
And all that sort of stuff. But
and I guess is and then it just goes back to my message. And I kind of went on a tangent there, but I was trying to move it on. Is that, you know, is if you can unplug yourself every now and then, just put the turn the TV off, and like I said, just go outside. You want to see some crazy stuff? Pick up a telescope. I mean, that stuff's there. You can live, and as humans, I think we can only really comprehend our immediate surroundings and a little bit beyond that. But once you start going deep space and start contemplating that stuff, that's when you get into woo-woo territory, and you're up late at night and shivering in your bed and wondering what's going to happen after you die. Yeah, but that was an interesting conversation. Interesting guy. I'd love to see. You can go to his website at, I'm going to have to look it up. I'll do it tomorrow when I do my intro. But that's it.
Like us on facebook.com/WWIPodcast and at WWIPodcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitwhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Enjoyed your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.
Oh, shit.